So let's open our Bibles then to that chapter I've just read, 1 Samuel and chapter 26. 1 Samuel, chapter 26. I wonder if you've ever had that feeling of what they call it, deja vu, the feeling you've been here before, been in this situation before. I wonder if you've ever had that. Certainly get that feeling, don't you, when you come to chapter 26. We've been here before with David. The opportunity to kill the unaware, unsuspecting, helpless Saul, taking some items to make it clear that David could have killed Saul. David then facing Saul with the fact and protesting his innocence and Saul acknowledging his unrighteousness. This chapter has remarkable similarities to chapter 24, where Saul enters the cave that David and his men are hiding in, and David has that opportunity to kill the man who's seeking to kill him. We have all the same ingredients, the opportunity, the taking of the evidence, the speeches. And when you look at this chapter, you wonder if there's anything new to say that you didn't say 2 weeks ago, or however many weeks ago it was when we were looking at chapter 24. But there's plenty for us to learn, there's new things to see, and there's old things to be reminded of again. The truth is that sometimes we manage to stand firm against a temptation once, but what happens if it comes again? Perhaps we're a bit self-confident the first time, and the second time it comes, who knows? Or perhaps we're prepared to wait for God's timing for a while, but when it doesn't turn out as we'd hoped, we can get impatient. Or, you know, we're prepared to give those who sin against us once, but if they come back and do it again, well, maybe that second time is one time too many. Those are all things that David, I mean, we know that we've read how the story unfolds, but those are all real things that David is faced with in this situation. And second time, he's left it the first time. It's probably a fair bit of time has passed since then. Saul's come back. No change. No difference. Another opportunity. What's he gonna do? Well, let's think about this chapter. You'll see we've got 6 headings. That's a bit alarming, isn't it? We'll make our way through fairly quickly. So first point, Saul's rekindled hatred. We've seen in these chapters just how dangerous it is, isn't it, to let envy and bitterness dwell in your hearts. That's one thing we've got to learn and see again from this chapter. We've seen how, from Saul, haven't we, how easily it can take over a person. Now, because we've been doing the life of David, we started a bit into Samuel, well, fair way into Samuel. We didn't look at the early chapters that tell us about the young Saul and him coming to his throne. But this is the man who'd hidden himself when they'd wanted to make him king. They had to search for him. He didn't really want to be the king. He seemed quite a quiet, timid, unassuming young man. And yet, look what envy and bitterness have done. They've turned him into a man who just will get rid of anyone who might possibly, you know, be a threat to him. That's what envy and hatred have done. Or if we'd looked at 1 Samuel chapter 11, when they've just made Saul king, and there's some people who aren't very sure about whether Saul's good enough to be king or fitting to be king, and then Saul goes and delivers Jabesh Gilead. You can read that story, and then he does a great thing, and the people who are on his side say, well, let's kill the people who were against you beforehand. And Saul has said, no. No, today's not a day for killing. And yet, look what bitterness and envy and jealousy have done. You remember, it led to him killing all the people of Nob, didn't it? That men, women, boys, girls, just because one of them had unknowingly helped David. This is a man who's, this is where bitterness, anger, hatred, jealousy can get you. It's a man who acts now in a way, we've seen, haven't we? He doesn't care what damage it does to his son. It doesn't, Jonathan doesn't care how it impacts his daughter, Michael. He's just filled with anger, and he's going to get rid. He's relentlessly pursuing David. Are you harboring envy, anger, bitterness, jealousy? Well, the word of God would just warn us, wouldn't it, of that. At the end of chapter 24, when Saul had seen that David had spared his life, you remember how he seemed repentant, didn't he? He seemed to acknowledge that he was, David was righteous and he was unrighteous, and he stopped pursuing David, and he'd returned home, and it would seem for a while he'd seen the error of his ways. It would seem to be the end of the matter, but this chapter reminds us that sin is a powerful thing. It's more powerful than us. Sin reigns in an unregenerate heart, doesn't it? And once again, we can see it taking control of Saul and rearing his ugly head. Again, his hatred and his determination to get rid of David just return again. And it's got him, hasn't it, this envy. It reminded me, I wrote down here, Cain and Abel. You remember when Cain is jealous of his brother, isn't he? And God comes to him and says, its desire is for you, but you must reign over it. But sin reigned in his heart, didn't it? And then just as I was reading through the chapter again this afternoon, I think you get a bit of a hint of Cain and Abel in verse 20, where David says, now do not let my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord. You remember that? It was the blood, wasn't it, of Abel that cried out to the Lord. So I think we've got a similarity here, haven't we, between Cain and Abel. I mean, that's the sort of prototype envy and hatred, isn't it? And you've got it here, haven't you, in this chapter as well. What happens when sin grips your heart? So we need to be warned. Here we are, all nice, respectable people, but you know what can happen when envy and bitterness grip your heart. But I want us to notice also that while Saul is totally responsible for his actions, the opening verse makes it clear that he was encouraged and stirred up to do this by the Ziphites. So who were the Ziphites? Well, we've already come across them once. They've done this once before. They dwelt in the wilderness of Ziph. That's why they're called the Ziphites. It doesn't take much to work that out, does it? But they were people from the tribe of Judah, actually, if you work it out. The very tribe that David came from. They should have been loyal, and yet they're disloyal. But notice again how they stir up Saul. It's very clever how they do it. They don't say, Saul, come and kill David. They realize they don't need to do that. They just drop in some information, don't they? In verse 1. Is David not hiding in the hill of Hakilah opposite Jeshimon? By the way, Saul, just in case you're interested, just in case you wanted to know where Saul was, David was, he's over there in that area. Just in case you wanted to know, we just thought we'd tell you. They know exactly what they're doing, don't they? It was all that was needed. These people will have to answer on the day of judgment for that. And how can we apply that? Well, we need to be careful, don't we, of doing something similar. How dangerous our words can be. How easy it is for us to slip something into the conversation, drop something in, a piece of information into someone's ear, you know, perhaps true, but we know it's just going to stir them up. It's going to stir up trouble. We say, by the way, just so you know, did you know that so-and-so said that or did that or went there? You all look lovely. You'd never do anything like that. But that's I know my own heart. We can be like that, can't we? We need to be warned. We can find that in our hearts if we're not careful, that love of just say, especially if we've got something against somebody or somebody's offended us or somebody's got a gift that we haven't got and we can let bitterness reign in our hearts or we can just, you know, what could we say to get them into, what could we say to stir, to make them look a bit worse and us look a bit better? There's a little warning for us. You know, by the way, Saul, did you know that where David's over here at the moment? I mean, Saul didn't need much encouragement, did he? But he's on his way very quickly with 3,000 of his choice men. And envy and hatred have gripped his heart again, haven't they? So there's the first point. Saul's rekindled hatred. Let's be careful about hatred and bitterness in our own hearts. And let's be very careful about anything that would stir it up in other people that we say. Secondly, God's wonderful protection. So what happens when Saul and his men arrive? Well, David, verse 4, sends out spies. He discovers that Saul has come and he discovers where he is. And so verse 5 tells us that David comes near to the camp. He can see it. He's got a vantage point. He can see it well enough to see where Saul is, where he's going to sleep with Abner next to him. And it makes it very clear, doesn't it, at the end of verse 5. There he is, in the middle. He's in the middle with all his men around him. I mean, he's protected, isn't he? 3,000 choice, top soldiers, elite soldiers, all around him. And David can see that. Then I was thinking this week, imagine being Ahimelech or Abishai. And when David goes, hang on, which one of you is going to come with me down to the camp? Anyone up for that? And I think, what would you have done? Would you have sort of kept your head down, or would you have volunteered? Well, Abishai volunteers, doesn't he? I'll go with you. I'm up for it. There's bravery here, isn't there? And so we can imagine them. We can see them. Let's picture them in the darkness, creeping down to the edge of the camp. And we think, what are they going to do? Are they going to kill a few men on the edge? Reduce the numbers a bit. And no, they keep going, don't they? They creep past the first ones. We can watch them sneaking around, getting into the middle of the camp. And they get right into the heart of it. And we're waiting for a soldier to wake up. We're waiting for a shout from the sentry on duty, but not a sound comes. And then they're there in the middle, aren't they? In the middle of them with stood over Saul. And you're waiting for them to strike him. And then you can see there's a conversation goes on between these two men. We'll come back to that in a while. And then what do? They grab the spear and they grab the water jug next to Saul and they creep their way back out and nobody moves and nobody says anything. And we go, this sounds, if this was a movie, we go, this is not real, is it? This is like the A-Team where the baddies shoot and nobody dies. You know, is this... Have these men got some unseen protection? And of course the answer is, yes, they do. You see, the Lord has determined that one of them is one day going to be the king of Israel. He's the Lord's anointed. And the Lord has his hand on him. So we read in verse 12, I've been praying for this for a few of you, that a deep sleep from the Lord will have fallen on you. That's what we read, haven't we, in verse 12. A deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. So that's amazing, isn't it? That here is Saul with all his seeming protection, and yet he's defenseless, really, isn't he? For all his seeming power and strength, he's utterly helpless. And there's David, he's got one man with him, and yet he's gloriously protected, isn't he? And we're reminded, let's take this to heart. Let's be reminded tonight, let's be encouraged tonight, that's a picture, isn't it, of the Lord's care of his people, that we're in his hands, that we're in his care, that he has his plans for us and his purposes for us, and he knows our days and the number of them, and we're safe and we're secure in him, and we can rest there and trust him. Not a single shaft will hit till the God of love sees fit. If God is for us, who can be against us? The Lord's wonderful protection. And then thirdly, David's patient faith. So let's go back into the darkness and into the middle of that camp, and let's listen in to what the conversation between these two, between David and Abishai. We've got it in verses 8 to 11, haven't we, there? So we can imagine this whispered conversation. They've made it to the middle of the camp. It's surrounded by sleeping soldiers. You don't want to be speaking very loudly, do you? They're whispering there. Saul lies at their feet. Abishai knows what he's going to do, doesn't he? He says, doesn't he, in verse 8, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. That's his reading of it. And he knows exactly what to do. I've got the spear. It'll only take one blow, David. I'll stick it through him into the ground. I won't need a second chance. How easy it would have been, wouldn't it? I mean, surely it's justified now. I mean, okay, he didn't do it the first time, but Saul's come back. And he's trying it again. He can't be trusted. Surely it's justified now. And as I said earlier, it's quite a long time since the last time. And it's still, David's nowhere near being king. Surely now is the time to take it into his own hands. But David won't do it. He says, doesn't he? Do not, verse 9, do not destroy him. David knew that simply the opportunity presenting itself didn't mean it's the right thing to do. Notice why David won't kill Saul. The answer comes in verse 9 and 10. There's two reasons. First of all, he knows it would be wrong. And secondly, because he's prepared to leave it to the Lord. So in verse 9 he says, who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? He knows that to kill Saul would be a sin. It would render him guilty. Saul is still the Lord's anointed. It's the Lord who's raised him up. It's the Lord who will bring him down. And that's the other reason, because David is ready to leave it to the Lord. He knows the Lord will deal with it. That's what does he say in verse 10? As the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. I mean, he's just seen it with Nabal, hasn't he, in the last chapter? The Lord has struck him down. And he's confident that the Lord's time, the Lord will do it in his own way, in his own time, and I'm going to trust him. This is important for us to see that though David doesn't know exactly what God will do, he knows what he must do. There are certain things that God keeps to himself, and there are things that God has made known, aren't there? And David is to concern himself with what God has made known, with his words. He knew that whatever the circumstances, however tempting, to kill the king would be wrong. And he has the faith to obey God's word and the faith to trust God's timing. And that again is a lesson for us, because we don't always understand God's providences. We don't always understand why God does things in certain ways, why God allows certain things to continue. We don't understand that there's a secret will of God, isn't there, that we just have to trust him in. But whilst there are things we don't know, there are things we do know. And that's what we've got to focus on, obeying his word. Someone's put it like this: God's ways will frequently baffle us, but God's will is sufficiently clear to lead us in the meantime. We may wait for God's providence, but we already have God's law. So there are things that, you know, David could say, oh, and I don't know how long it's going to be, and I don't know when God's going to, but I know this, it would be wrong for me to put him to death. So we've got to focus on, there are lots of things in our lives that are perplexing. But there are certain things that are clear. How we're to live, who we're to put first, to trust and obey. And we're reminded of that in this chapter. David's patient faith. And our lives need to be marked by patient faith as well. Perhaps that's your particular need tonight, for patient faith, to trust the Lord, come what may. One reason we ought to trust him is because the Lord's patient with us. I mean, generally speaking, we like to align ourselves with David in these stories. But the truth is that we could very well be aligned with Saul, couldn't we? I mean, David is the Lord's anointed. He's the king, isn't he? He's representing God. And what have we tried to do? Well, we tried to get rid of God, didn't we? That's what sin is. We time and time and time again. I mean, we could very easily say, well, we've just been like Saul, haven't we, with God? And God has been, God could have dealt with us in a moment. And yet he's been very patient with us and had mercy on us and saved us. So we ought to be patient in trusting him and waiting his timing. So David's patient faith. David's speech, that's the next thing I want us to think about for a moment. That's verses 12 and 13. Tell us that having taken Saul's spear and jug as evidence that where he's been, David and Abishai make their way through the valley and onto the top of the hill, a long way off, but within shouting distance. And then David begins to shout out and call, doesn't he? It seems from verse 14, where from the fact that David says, "Do you not answer Abner?" It sounds like perhaps it's taken him a while to wake up. This is a deep sleep from the Lord. If you can remember to having children, if you had children, you know, when they wake up in the middle of the night and you've got to try and come round and make a decision and think about things. Well, you know, they've been in a deep sleep, haven't they? And eventually they come, "Well, do you not answer Abner?" So he addresses Abner first of all, doesn't he? He taunts him, really. Are you not a man? Who is like you in Israel, Abner? I mean, you are impressive, aren't you? What's your job again? Oh, to look after your master, isn't it? To keep him safe. Every meeting, every situation, you're supposed to look after him. Where's his spear? Where's his water jug, Abner? Somewhat embarrassing, isn't it, for Abner? Humiliating. But then Saul takes over, doesn't he, in verse 17. Is that your voice, my son, David? I mean, if ever there was an empty word, my son. This man pursuing him like a wild animal, isn't he, as David says later on. But David responds graciously, but protests his innocence more than once in verse 18. Let me just read verse 18 and 19 again. Why does my Lord thus pursue his servant? For what have I done? Or what evil is in my hand? Now, therefore, please let my Lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is the children of men, may they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. There's two things I want us to notice there in David's words. Firstly, he seeks to get Saul to think about who it is who's driving him to do this. That's verse 19, isn't it? Who is it? Who's driving you to do this, Saul? Is it the Lord who stirred you up against me, do you think? I mean, if so, let me offer a sacrifice and let's deal with this. Or is it men who've done this to you? Now, of course, Saul knows the answer to that, doesn't he? He knows it's not the Lord. He's not on the Lord's business, is he? That's a good question. That's a good thing for us to think about whenever we're doing anything, isn't it? Who's stirring us up to do this? Who are we doing this for? Whose honor are we concerned about as we do this thing? Am I concerned about the Lord? Am I concerned about his name, his honor? Or am I doing it for some other reason? But then notice what it is that burdens David. This is the second thing I want us to notice about David's speech. What is it? What's David's burden as he's being pursued? Is it the fact that he's lost everything? Is it the fact that he's got no home? It's actually the fact, isn't it, that he's been driven from God's people. That's what's burdened him, isn't it? That these people are seeking to drive him out from amongst the Lord's people, the inheritance of the Lord. Basically, they're saying to him, "You go and end of verse 19, go and serve other gods." That's what grieves David. The fact that what's happening to him is means that he can't be amongst the people of God. He can't go up to the temple to worship. He can't offer a sacrifice with the people. And that's the burden, isn't it? And then there's a challenge again. What grieves us when things go wrong in our lives? Where do our priorities, what burdens us most? What do we consider most precious, our possessions, our homes, or our place amongst the people of God? I mean, that's the most precious thing we have, isn't it? That we have a place in the inheritance of the Lord. And we don't want to go and serve any other gods. David's speech. Well, what's driving you, Saul? And then his concern for his own place in the people of God. Fifthly, Saul's sad confession. verse 21. I mean, Saul is such a tragic figure, isn't he? Because he does admit his sin. I've sinned, he says. Indeed, further on, he says, I've played the fool and erred exceedingly. In the light of David sparing him a second time, he sees himself, he sees his life for what he is. He sees what he's done. He's a sinner, he's a fool. He's no better than Nabal in the last chapter. He admits that. I mean, what is a fool? A fool is someone who lives as if there's no God, or says in their heart there's no God, and goes their own way and does their own thing. And he says, I've erred exceedingly. This is the path I should have gone on, and I've gone away from it. I mean, in some ways, it's a real honest confession, and yet what is so sad is that we know, don't we, there's no real repentance. There's no real turning from his sin, is there, in Saul's life? He will go on in his sin, and within a year or so, he'll fall on his sword in battle. I mean, it's just a reminder, isn't it? It's not enough, is it, to just acknowledge your sin. I mean, there's plenty of people who will say, oh, yeah, I'm a sinner, and will acknowledge that, but they stop there and don't turn to the Lord and repent and cast themselves on the mercy. This was an opportunity for Saul. I mean, he could have repented. He could have sought the Lord in this moment, but he doesn't actually do that. Yes, he goes, oh, yeah, I've sinned, I've erred. See, I mean, he's ashamed. But that isn't enough, is it? So what I'm asking, is there anyone here tonight who's sort of acknowledged their sin, knows that they've messed up, had a guilty conscience, but never gone any further than that? Just left it there. That is not enough, is it? You've got to go to Jesus Christ, the one who can deal with your sin, and give up everything and follow him. One last thing. We've got David's trusting prayer at the end. So, I mean, David isn't stupid, is he? Saul says to David to return. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more. But David doesn't come to Saul. He rather tells Saul to send one of his young men to collect the spear. But notice what David says in verse 24. He says, indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in... What would we expect him to say? We might expect him to say, in your eyes. You see that? He says, as your life was valued much to this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in... But he doesn't say in your eyes, does he? What does he say? In the eyes of the Lord. In the eyes of the Lord. You see, that's what David's concerned about. Not what Saul thinks of him. He realizes that can come and go and change. It's not reliable at all. What he wants to, he wants to know that his life is valuable and precious to the Lord. Because that's who to trust in, isn't it? That's who you want looking after you. I mean, he's just proved that you can have 3,000 men around you and it's no help at all. Don't put your trust in men. Put your trust in the Lord who made, as we were thinking this morning, heaven and earth. That's to be our concern then, isn't it? You know, we're so often concerned about what other people think about us and whether other people value us. And of course, it's not entirely unimportant, is it? But what we need, what's most precious is that we're precious in the eyes of the Lord. And we are as his people, aren't we? We're precious in his eyes. He loves us. He's given his son for us. And we can trust him and we can look to him and we can rest in him. What a glorious position to be in. To be able to come and say, let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. And of course, there are many Psalms of David where he rejoices in that fact that he is precious in the eyes of the Lord. The Lord does know him and the Lord will deliver him out of all his troubles and bring him through his troubles. Doesn't mean he doesn't have any troubles. I mean, he's in the midst of a troubled situation here, isn't he? But the Lord will bring him through. Do you notice the last sentence? So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place, and they never met again. This is the last time there was any real contact between these two men. And Saul goes on to his solemn end. He'll fall on his sword on the battlefield, alone, having consulted a medium. And David will go on to, as the Lord's anointed, to be the king. And yes, ups and downs. Yes, as we'll see, failures and sins and sorrows. But the Lord's and precious in his sight, and safe for all eternity. So is that your position tonight? Are you here in this room? Cast on the Lord, trusting him, knowing that what matters more than anything is that you're precious and in his sight. What a place to be this evening.